Today at Radio Verulam, we are once again speaking to local MP Daisy Cooper to get the answers to your questions. And remember, if you've not been lucky enough to get the answers from Daisy this time, she will be back again next month. But since we last talked, Daisy, there was a lot of furore around Christmas being on or off. Were you still able to enjoy the festive period?
Well, I think like most people, my plans went out the window. I had planned to go and see my mum, but obviously she's been shielding for a long time. So we were just going to sit in the garden with blankets and try and have some stew in a cup. That was the plan for Christmas Day, but obviously we couldn't even do that. So we stayed at home, just myself and my husband, and we made the most of it, having a nice meal. And that was the way we got through it.
But the continued thing about this lockdown period has been a total lockdown. Christmas was changed for all of us, as you said there, but we've entered a national lockdown as well. So I do have to ask, how much has this affected your work as an MP? Have you been able to kind of change your routine so that you can still help as many people as possible?
Well, I mean, for the last 10 or 11 months, I've been doing virtual surgeries and, you know, continuing to take part in parliamentary procedures in a virtual way as well. So that just continues. I think what we have noticed, however, is that we're getting a lot more inquiries from local residents, and, you know, we're here to answer them. But there's lots of new questions coming in about vaccines and about tests. But we're also starting to see the re-emergence of similar issues that we've seen before. So, you know, as various deadlines, government deadlines come up, people are saying, well, you know, is the universal credit going to continue? What new support is there going to be for my business? You know, I need to renegotiate at least my landlord. What protections do I have? Questions about whether people can stay in their homes. There's a lot of issues that sort of come up periodically as we approach a government deadline. Those have been coming up again as well. So we're trying to respond to those as quickly as we can.
Now, talking about government deadlines, government issues that we've seen over the past few weeks since we last talked, Ed Davey, your party leader, said that Gavin Williamson was the worst education secretary in living memory. Daisy, can you explain why Ed said this, and what would the Liberal Democrats do differently?
Well, he's absolutely right. I think that pupils and parents and teachers have had a really tough time over the last year, largely because decisions have been taken at the last moment. Often guidance has been issued on a Friday night and changed six times before the following morning. And there hasn't been any kind of forward planning to help pupils and parents and teachers actually prepare for what they should be learning and what should be taught. So we had the whole fiasco around the A-levels last August, when the government used an algorithm, but they had about a week's notice that it hadn't worked in Scotland, and they did nothing about it. Then we had the whole mess about schools reopening without any testing put in place, and that then meant that within a couple of weeks, lots of students were stuck at home. Then we had calls by medical advisors for a national lockdown, and the government was so slow in reacting to that. They didn't use the half term, which was a natural break, to implement that lockdown, which meant we ended up with a national lockdown, you know, in November, albeit with some schools staying open. And then there was a whole debacle with, you know, the government threatening schools that tried to close down early before Christmas. So some schools wanted to close down early to get the reproductive rate down, the R rate down, and they were told that, you know, there would be very kind of, the government's very strong response was to threaten those schools with legal action. And then, of course, a few weeks after Christmas, they were then being told that they had to stay open and then close 24 hours later. And now in a situation where we were told GCSEs and A-levels would go ahead, and now we're being told that they're not, but then some of them might go ahead in some kind of form. And so it's been really, really tough for schools that have been trying to maintain their teaching in the classroom, trying to deliver teaching in a virtual sense as well to children studying from home. Teachers have also been stretched in terms of being asked to do the contact tracing and policing social distancing on site and maintaining attendance records on site, whilst also dealing with the pressures on their own teachers and the impact of COVID on the workforce and trying to balance their budgets. So time and time and time again, the Secretary of State for Education has just got every single decision wrong, and I honestly believe that our students and their families really deserve a lot better.
Do you factor in, though, that obviously this is an unprecedented COVID situation, or is this just unacceptable on all levels?
Well, of course, the pandemic is unprecedented, and it was particularly, you know, it was unprecedented when it first arrived last March. But you know, even last spring, there was talk of a second or a possible third wave. There were lots and lots of warnings about what would happen if students went back to school without testing in place. There were lots of warnings about what would happen if young students went to university without testing in place. And so, at every single stage, there have been warnings from the sector, from teachers, from families, from medical experts, and the government just hasn't listened to those warnings. They're very well documented at every single stage. And as an opposition MP, I've been calling since last July for lump sum budgets to schools so they could actually budget for the extra teaching they needed. In October, I was calling for a plan to keep schools open safely, and the government hasn't acted on that. And in November, I was calling for the government to make a decision on cancelling GCSEs and A-levels in order that pupils and parents had some degree of certainty. And obviously, the government's dragged its heels in that regard as well. So the evidence has been there at every single stage. There have been warnings at every single stage. The government has just been behind the curve, making last-minute decisions, and it's caused chaos for people's lives.
Now, this month, you've also given a warning yourself to the Prime Minister. You talked to him in Prime Minister's Questions, and you asked Boris Johnson for greater and more consistent supply for vaccines in St Albans. He did reply that things would be ramping up soon, but no time frame was given. So what can we expect to see from the Prime Minister's commitment? Will it come true anytime soon, Daisy?
Jason, I honestly don't know is the answer. I honestly don't know. The government hasn't given me any kind of time frame. I don't have any kind of intel on this. There are lots of different MPs of, you know, all sorts of different political parties, including the Conservative Party, who are putting these questions to the government and to the Secretary of State for Health. But for those sort of those of your listeners who missed my question, the point I was making was that we're incredibly lucky in St Albans that we have the Batchford Hall Vaccination Centre up and running, but they only have enough vaccine supply to be doing vaccines on 2 days a week. They're absolutely ready and willing to be doing that 7 days a week. They just need the vaccines to be delivered to them. And what we've seen across the country is that, you know, some parts of the country have got the vaccine, but it's arriving often just at a couple of days' notice, which means there's suddenly a real rush and pressure on the GPs to make sure they've got all the vaccinators ready, that they can get the patients through the door. So it just makes it really difficult for them to be able to plan. So what we really need from the government is a proper sort of timeline, even if it's just for the next 2 or 3 weeks, to be able to say, you know, this is how much supply we're getting, this is where it's going to go to, now you can start to book these various people. So we don't have any kind of timeline on that yet. As soon as I have one, I'll definitely be sharing it with local residents, but I'm afraid at this moment I simply do not know.
Now, you've actually tried to help the area in other ways this month, and this was on a much more local level. There you were speaking to the Prime Minister in the special kind of Prime Minister's Questions over Zoom. But at a local level, you were speaking to residents. You spent your Saturday afternoon with other Lib Dem councillors and members phoning residents from home to see how they were during the lockdown. What was the general mood amongst residents? And do you think that you actually helped lift spirits by talking to them?
Well, I mean, it was a really lovely afternoon, actually, speaking to local people. As you know, Liberal Democrats, we're often knocking on doors and speaking to people face to face, but we just can't do that at the moment. And therefore, the phone is the sort of second best option. I'd say it was a really mixed reaction. I think most people were very grateful to have a phone call, and we were able to sort of pass on sources of advice and help and support, and I was able to answer a few questions that people had about vaccines and about schools and those kinds of issues. I think some people just said they were a bit bored at the moment. They're a bit bored of lockdown, you know, which is fair enough. Other people were quite lonely. I know that one of our councillors got through to an elderly couple who hadn't spoken to anybody for a week, hadn't spoken to anybody at all, and so they really appreciated the phone call and just wanted to have a natter. And then there was a couple of people that I spoke to who were clearly very anxious as well about the current situation. And it's always important to remember that, you know, we're all in the same boat, but some of us have got bigger storms than others, I think it's fair to say. You know, some people are some people are managing okay. We've all got our different battles. I think that we're fighting in different ways, but some people are kind of broadly okay. Other people are really struggling. And when we come across people who do need our help or need to be directed to some support or advice, then it's really, really rewarding when we can actually do that, because that's why we're making the phone calls, really. So a mixed response, but overall, I think people were pleased to know that there's people in the community, our Liberal Democrat councillors and activists, who are just checking that people are all right.
Well, that's good to hear that you're able to make a positive difference. And again, this month you tried to make another positive difference because you wrote to the government about the free school meal hampers problems that were at an unacceptable level. That's what it's been described as. How many children were actually affected in St Albans? And are there any assurances that this won't happen again for your constituents?
It's a great question. And the honest answer is that I'm trying to get to the bottom of it. So I know that there are some families in St Albans who were affected. I've received some photographs of the food that they received, and these boxes appeared to be pretty much half empty. And in my office, we compared what was in the photograph with the list of what they should have been getting. Obviously, the free school meals is a government scheme, but they're actually delivered by our local county council. One of the providers that we believe have provided this box denies that it is their box. And so there's a bit of a dispute going on at the moment. So I don't know how many children overall have been affected, but I know for sure that there are children in St Albans who are affected. And quite frankly, I think the government needs to be trusting families to know what food they should be buying for their kids. You know, there's no point giving a child a box of food, you know, with tuna and cheese if the child has got a fish and a dairy allergy, you know. So parents do know what food they should be buying for their kids and should be given, you know, either cash payments, which is, you know, cash payments or vouchers. There's a scheme in Wales that was set up by the Liberal Democrat Education Minister in Wales, Kirsty Williams, where the money was given to local councils and the local councils often made a sort of cash transfer into people's banks and things like that. So there are other ways of doing it that fundamentally trusts families to buy the food that they need for their kids. And there is a better way of doing it. So I hope that we'll see the back of these half empty boxes.
Now, talking of other ways of doing things, one of the big discussions this week has been about cancelling the cut to universal credit. This difference can make life or loss to a lot of families here. And this is also bringing in the discussions of debt, national debt, and also austerity, once again, that big A word that scares a lot of people. And I wanted to ask the question of why is there such a focus on national debt being out of control? An example I'm giving to you, obviously, this is a different time period, but I'm also presenting this to Bambos Charalambos of Labour and Bim Afalami of the Conservatives as well to have a fair view on this. But the fact is that post-World War II, Keynesianism economics were incorporated to help Britain recover. The books weren't focused on until the country had recovered. So why should balancing the books take precedent now over the long-term growth of the country? Now, I will add that actually this is something echoed by Joe Biden when he made his inauguration speech.
Sure. Well, there's two things I would say, I guess, in response to this. The first is that it really, really irritates me that people say that we should only start talking about national debt in the context of conversations about helping people who are at the bottom rung of the ladder. You know, we could be talking about national debt when we talk about how much, you know, the billions that the government spent on a failed test and trace system. You know, we could talk about national debt in the context of the billions that have been given to various companies, you know, potentially through slightly dodgy procurement practices. We could be talking about national debt in the context of tax avoidance. But it always seems to be that when you're looking at those people who are either living in poverty or are struggling on the breadline, that's when people say they can't afford things. And the first thing I should say is we should absolutely not be looking to balance the books on the shoulders of the poor. That is absolutely a first principle. The second point is that we do have to have a national discussion about how we deal with the debt, because there is no doubt that we are racking up a lot of national debt. What Liberal Democrats have been saying is similar to what you said. You know, we've been saying for many months that, you know, we should treat this as a national crisis. There is no reason why we need to pay back the debt immediately. We could look at a long-term repayment plan effectively. But the key thing is to get the economy up and running again. And the key and the main way of doing that is to invest. So, you know, we've been calling for an investment in a green recovery plan. You know, we've called for billions to be spent on this over the next 3 years. That would create jobs, it would attract inward investment, it would help businesses recover. And only when we get the economy up and running again can we then work out, you know, who should be paying more and who should be paying more by way of tax, and how do we manage public spending, etc. So I think there's 2 points there about, you know, first of all, who should be paying and why are we only talking about debt when it comes to these decisions about helping people, you know, who really do need help. And secondly, I think it needs to be a longer term discussion about investment and investing in our industries and recovery now, and looking at a longer term way of dealing with the debt.
Now, let's move the conversation on to ones of the local community there. And as always with these discussions, Radio Verulam is here to help the community, as you are yourself, Daisy. And we called for questions for you. So let's move it on to what the people of our local area want to know. And one of the first community questions is from Mandy. And she said that Boris Johnson said, "We've virtually done as many vaccines as all other European countries put together, but the methodology of vaccination is not the scientifically correct one, and people's health are being put at risk as we don't know what spacing the vaccines 12 weeks apart is safe or not. Why is this being allowed to happen?" Mandy asks.
Okay, it's a good question, and a lot of people have contacted me to actually ask similar questions to this. The fact is that if we were in a much better place and we had enough vaccine to be able to follow the guidelines that have emerged from the early scientific evidence, then of course we would be following the advice around this spacing. The fact is that we are in an emergency. We are in an absolutely emergency position, and the changes have been adopted in a way that are consistent with public health principles. And because we are in an emergency with an incredibly high mortality rate at the moment, with enormous pressure on our NHS, the decision has been made in order to try and protect the greatest number of people as quickly as possible. And what the sort of manufacturers have said is that the data that they've got only looks at the impact with this 12-week gap. It doesn't look at, they haven't got any data to look at what the impact might be, but there are lots of studies that are happening very quickly to look at the impact and the effect. But this decision has been taken in line with public health principles. And as I say, it's been done in order to give to protect the greatest number of people as quickly as possible. And it's just really, really important that people understand that. For those people who do get a vaccine, as well, I think it's really important to remember what the vaccines can do. So if you get the vaccine, you can still get COVID. So it doesn't mean you're not going to get it. You can still get it, but it means it's more likely that it will be less severe. So it sort of reduces your chances of mortality, reduces the chances of you getting bad symptoms. But at the moment, we believe that you can still transmit COVID even if you've had the vaccine. So even if you get the vaccine, you need to wait a little bit of time for it to kick in. You could still get COVID, you could still give it to other people, but by getting to as many people as possible as quickly as possible, it should reduce the number of people that are dying of COVID, should reduce the number of people that are getting really severe symptoms, and that in turn will help reduce pressure on the NHS.
So you're actually pro this idea then, that Mandy's worries are a little bit dissipated by the science that is still ongoing. Is that your belief there, Daisy?
Well, I understand that people are anxious, for sure, but and I'm not going to pretend to be a medical expert, but I have quizzed the government's medical advisers on this, and I think what is clear is that we are taking actions that are appropriate in an emergency, and therefore the plan to protect the greatest number of people as quickly as possible seems to me to be an incredibly sound public health principle. And I think that under the circumstances, given the emergency we're in, I think it is the right decision.
Now, let's move on to party politics for a little bit here, because Mike is actually a local Lib Dem party member, and he expresses here in his question, "I'm a long-time member of the party, but I'm worried about the future of us." He said, "What are the next steps for the Liberal Democrats to grow? Where do the Liberal Democrats go from here, and what's our strategy before getting there?
Sure. I mean, this seems like a question you ask me every single month, so I'll give you the same answer. I mean, basically, you know, the Liberal Democrats, we are in second place to the Conservatives in around 80 seats around the country. And when I became a deputy leader, I was elected by my fellow MPs. I said that I wanted to build up our capacity so we had the greatest chance of winning as many of those seats as possible at the next general election. At the same time, we have a very important set of local elections that are coming up in May. We have elections here in St Albans and in Hertfordshire. And hopefully, I hope our local community will have seen the impact that our local Liberal Democrat councillors have had. Not only are they making, you know, brilliant decisions, taking 100 actions to tackle the climate emergency here in St Albans, delivering plans to deliver social housing, but also they've been on the front line as volunteers, you know, up at the vaccination centre, marshalling the cars, even cleaning the toilets. You know, we've been pitching in and making a real difference. So we have got elections across the country, and for local elections, which are really important in and of themselves, but there's a long but methodical process in place which we are following to make sure that we're match fit for the next general election as well.
I suppose then to summarise for Mike, are you feeling more positive than he is for the future of the party?
Well, I guess, you know, I've been a member of the party for 12 years and I've seen us bounce around in the polls from about 5% to 25%. And what I know is that where we have strong advocates of liberal principles, people who are pro-internationalists, who are pro-environmentalists, who are pro-business and pro-public services, where we have inspiring, active candidates, you know, they inspire their communities to action and then they can win. So part of my job is to help find some of those candidates, get them into the seats that we can win, and then to make sure that they work really hard for the next few years. So I know that, you know, if you look at the national polls, they can be a bit depressing from time to time, but quite frankly, the polls don't translate under our voting system of first past the post. So over the last 12 years, I've learned to take them with a pretty large bucket of salt. So yeah, I guess I'm the eternal optimist and I'm certainly more optimistic than Mike.
Well, hopefully that does make Mike feel a bit more positive for the Liberal Democrat future. But let's move it back to St Albans. And Ian has asked the question here that St Albans has the lowest COVID numbers in Hertfordshire and is actually seeing a reduction in numbers quickly too. Why do you think this is?
Well, first of all, let me just say we are seeing a sort of reduction in numbers, but that's from an incredibly high point. So people should not think that this is coming down to the levels that are anywhere near like we had before Christmas. The numbers are still absolutely sky high. So it's always nice when numbers start to come down. But, you know, it's not coming down anywhere near fast enough or close enough to what might be a level where we can all start to relax a little bit. That's the first thing to say. The second thing is there's no very sort of quick and easy explanation, but I mean, my hunch is that it's to do with our relative wealth. The fact is, in St Albans, we have a lot of people who have office jobs, who can work from home, who are able to self-isolate, who have the funds to be able to do that. But in many other parts of both Hertfordshire and across the country, there are people who can't. If you are a frontline worker or your job depends on actually going out or possibly even going into other people's houses, then of course you are more at risk of COVID. And what has very clearly come through from this whole pandemic is that wealth is the largest protector of your health in these circumstances. And I think, you know, in St Albans, obviously we have many people in St Albans who are struggling, who are not in that position. But overall, if you look at the demographics, we've got a larger number of people who are able to work from home and to sort of protect themselves, as it were, by reducing their transmission. And so I think it is probably down to that. As I say, I do think that in that regard we're quite lucky. It's not everybody in St Albans, and many people who are struggling, who are on the front line, who are going out and who are putting themselves at risk, particularly those in NHS and social care who are still going into hospitals and care homes to keep other people safe. But I think that is probably a large part of it.
Linked to this question, Sarah has also asked, why do you think COVID cases rose and why have we had to go into this second, although it is actually a third lockdown.
Yeah. Well, so what happened, I think, in November was obviously transmission rates had gone up, so more people were getting COVID. And then we had the second lockdown that was in November. And then there was what the government referred to at the time as a puzzle. And the puzzle they had was that despite these very severe restrictions and the second national lockdown in November, the rates weren't coming down necessarily in some places, but they were actually going up in others, particularly in Kent. And then as soon as the second lockdown lifted in sort of early December, those rates suddenly then started to go through the roof. And it's a combination of ongoing transmission, but also the arrival of this second strain. So the second strain, which we know is more transmissible, it can, you know, you can transmit it 70%, between 50 and 70% more likely to pass it to somebody else. And it's this second strain that has caused the rates to go through the roof. We're now hearing of other strains, you know, it's one from sort of South America and possibly others from around the world, which, you know, we need to sort of, we need to be checking at the borders. But there are other strains and we don't quite know what their impact is going to be. But it's not, you know, it's clear that we need to keep an eye on this. So I think it was the combination of ongoing transmission rates from the first strain of the virus that we had, and the fact that the lockdowns hadn't really been working so well, not least because the government's test, trace and isolate system has basically not worked for months now, or hasn't really worked at all. But it was a combination of the existing problem that we had combined with this this second more ferocious strain that arrived in late November.
Do you think as well that there was too much focus on not cancelling Christmas, staying open, keeping shops open? Because obviously in some industries, 60% plus of their actual income comes over the festive period.
I mean, the fact is that I think what we've seen is if you can get a hold of the virus and if you can drive the rates down, then people are healthier and the economy can reopen. So actually tackling the virus and supporting and saving lives and saving livelihoods are two sides of the same coin. And it's been really unfortunate. I think they've been pitted against each other as if there's been a trade-off. It's just not correct. And if you look at the countries that have got their response to COVID right, they acted really swiftly, took really dramatic action to drive the rates of the virus down. And that enabled them to open their economy up. I think what we saw in November was the government has admitted that it had this puzzle, as it referred to it, which was that, you know, we had the restrictions and the numbers weren't coming down and in some areas were going up, and yet the government still thought that it would be okay to lift a second lockdown. Now, I'm not inside the head of Boris Johnson. I'm not inside the head of the, I'm not inside the cabinet meetings. I don't know why they took that decision, but there were many people warning at the time that the rates were going up and the government wasn't intervening. And I don't know why, once again, they were dragging their heels and taking action late. But at the time before Christmas, many of us were saying, if you're going to change the guidance, please do it, you know, in good time and give people good notice. But as it happened, like with so many decisions of this government, it happened very late in the day and a lot of people were very upset. And some people, they were told they couldn't go and have Christmas with their families when they were already on the motorway. What I really hope the government might start to learn is to take decisions in good time so people can actually plan ahead.
Now, moving it again to a local issue, and Jay has messaged in here explaining about the local Batchwood vaccination centre. He says that, I feel happy there's a large vaccine centre in St Albans at Batchwood, but it also worries me the distance from the main road. If you're old and at risk, the journey in this weather, especially if there's ice, is dangerous. Taking a car is not open to everyone. Public transport is high risk, and a taxi would also expose people. What options are there if you can't make it to Batchwood, as the unspoken rule seems to be take whatever vaccine booking you are given?
So, I mean, Jay's right. We are lucky to have this wonderful centre at Batchwood. It's not a huge distance from the main road. There is, for anybody who is driving, they have access to salt up there, so they can actually treat any kind of snow and ice and issues like that. So it can be made secure. Once people arrive, there are lots of people on site who are masked up and all sort of socially distanced and can help people with you know, with wheelchairs and access into the building and all of that. So there are lots of provisions in place to help people. Because it's being run by GPs, I think the GPs generally know which of their patients are genuinely housebound. So if somebody is genuinely housebound, then the GPs can make arrangements to go and vaccinate them in their homes. But of course, as part of this huge national effort to vaccinate as many people as quickly as possible, if anybody has a way of getting to the vaccination centre, then hopefully they can get there. So there have been people going up there in taxis. It's possible to get in a taxi and, you know, have your mask on and windows open, etc., and to get there in a way that's sort of reasonably safe. I'm making inquiries to see whether there's any kind of additional options in place for volunteers to help with that effort in a COVID secure way, but there's not quite, I haven't managed to get those answers yet, so I'm still looking into it. But generally speaking, if people can get there in a car, then I would encourage them to do that. If they're able to get a taxi, I would also encourage them to do that as well. If they can't, then, you know, if they genuinely are housebound, they've got no other way of getting there, then please contact, when your GP contacts you, raise it with them at that point, because they can put provisions in place.
Well, that's good advice there then for Jay. I'm not sure if he's concerned about himself or a family member there, but hopefully, again, that gives him a bit of reassurance. Now, Liz has asked the question about an early day motion that you put to Parliament. She explains it was in a bid to include menstrual clothing in period products tax exemption. She asked, how is the progress on this? Do you believe there will be victory in fairness?
Well, I hope there will be. And this is one of these bizarre issues which you kind of think, why on earth are we still having to have this argument? The fact is that menstrual products for women don't attract a tax if they are disposable. So, you know, tampons and sanitary towels and all the rest of it. But if you have reusable sort of period pants, then you do have to still pay tax on them. And so it's a ridiculous, first of all, it's fundamentally unfair, but it also sets up a ridiculous incentive system where you are incentivized to buy the disposable products that are bad for the environment because we're using so many, and you're disincentivized from actually using the ones that are good for the planet instead. So I have put down this early day motion, which is it's a form of a parliamentary petition that MPs can sign to show that they think this is an important issue. Another Liberal Democrat MP, who is our spokesperson for business, she is actually in the process of doing a letter that she's asking MPs from different parties to make a cross-party letter to the government, asking for them to address this in the upcoming budget. And I will be looking for opportunities to raise it as well. And I should say that I'm not sure if I'm allowed to promote this or not. If I'm not, you'll have to edit it out, Jason. But we're very lucky in St Albans to have a very inspirational woman who has her own business where she's actually designed and manufacturing these period pants. And she has an amazing history and story about her own life and what's inspired her to make these. And she's utterly determined to make them accessible, especially for young girls who are maybe just starting their periods, who maybe can't, you know, afford to have all these, have to buy all these products every single month. So I think hopefully the government will take this seriously, and if they do, it'll be a good thing for the environment and a good thing to tackle period poverty as well.
Well, you know, you are allowed to talk about this amazing product. I think we should open out on it more, because I think it is such an important topic to discuss. So could you give us, you know, a little bit more information about the retailer and this amazing journey that they have been on?
Sure. Well, I encourage you, actually, maybe you should get her onto your show. It's a woman called Ruby Rout, and she lives in St Albans, and she will do a better job of telling you about her backstory. She's produced what's called the Wooka Pants, up and kick ass. So W-U-K-A, and these are the Wooka Pants, and there are some other, you know, other companies that do them as well, but the Wooka Pants, as I say, these are they're reusable period pants. She manufactures them, she sort of, I think, sort of sells them from her base here in St Albans. I was really honoured and delighted when she spoke at an event that I organised last March, I think probably about 2 weeks before the lockdown, which was, we were celebrating International Women's Day, and she spoke to a room of about sort of 50-60 people down at the Fighting Cocks, and we discussed, you know, her journey and her desire to roll these to roll out these reusable period pants for sale, but also to get sponsorship to get them into schools so that young girls who might be struggling with period poverty don't have to struggle anymore.
This was actually something that was in the Liberal Democrat manifesto, wasn't it, that period products would be not only tax exempt, but it would be free. Is this something that maybe you would work on after this milestone?
So I think tax has already been reduced. Tax has already been either reduced to 5% and possibly to zero on some menstrual products. The key fight now is to make sure that that applies to the reusable ones as well, like period pants. And as I say, myself and my Lib Dem colleague who leads for us on the business portfolio will be making that case very strongly to the Chancellor, and we'll see, fingers crossed, if he picks it up in the spring budget.
Well, we shall see. We will keep a close eye on it because it's something, as you've explained there, with Ruby Rout's amazing period pants there, that is a local issue as well because it affects so many people. Now, Tina has moved the question on to actually the PMQs. She's obviously seen that you asked the question this month, but she said, do you prefer the new way of doing Prime Minister's questions?
So, I mean, I'm happy with either way of Prime Minister's questions, to be honest, but I do think that the system where you have some people in the chamber physically and some people doing it virtually, it does seem to be a bit more civil. Certainly, before the pandemic, when as a new MP, I would sit in the chamber for Prime Minister's questions, I have to say it's so flipping noisy and so boisterous, and there's so much sort of cheering and jeering that, you know, it's actually very difficult to actually hear what people are saying. When you're watching it on TV, the microphones pick up what the speakers are saying. But when you're sitting in the chamber, it's actually very, very difficult to hear it. It's a bit like being at a football match. It's that loud, you know. I do prefer it because it's actually easier to hear what's going on, easier to follow what's going on, and sometimes there's a half a chance that you might get a better answer than when you've got all these people jeering behind the speakers.
I do want to move it, you know, inspired by Tina there though, but should there be serious consideration of maybe changing the way that PMQs is done for people, you know, with hearing difficulties or even with mental health issues that are activated by loud situations? It's not all inclusive for people of all abilities.
Sure, and I think that goes, you can say that about a lot of things in Parliament, to be honest. I think there is certainly a determination by the Speaker and also the Procedure Committee to try and make Parliament more accessible. The problem we have is that it's the MPs themselves who vote on these issues. So we sort of regulate our own workplace. And for as long as you have MPs that prioritise tradition over accessibility, then we're going to struggle to get some of these changes. I hope that maybe one day that will change and that the vast majority of MPs will prefer to vote in favour of more accessible measures, and they'll regard that as more important than just keeping tradition for tradition's sake. But we're not there yet, but many of us will continue to bang the drum in the hope that one day we can make some changes to be more accessible to people of all sorts of people who are, whether it's, you know, you're physically disabled, whether it's a mental ill health, or whether it's neurodiversity, whatever the differences might be. I think Parliament's got a long way to go on many of these issues, including PMQs.
Yes, and do you think that maybe because we've seen this new way of PMQs and maybe a culture of more empathy because of COVID, do you think that those changes will come about in the next Parliament, or is this here to stay?
I think it's really hard to say at the moment. There's no doubt that by moving to a kind of virtual Parliament, there are some things that we're missing. So it's much harder to have the number of debates that we used to have in Parliament. Because Parliament as a whole has not only the chamber, but there's lots of debates that happen in all sorts of meeting rooms around the chamber. And not all of them have been able to get online yet. So some of them have, some of them haven't. And so I think some of the practices and procedures have been an improvement. I personally like the fact that there's now a list. It's far more transparent to say who's going to be speaking and in what order. And I think that provides, you know, it helps you as an MP plan your day to know whether you're going to get picked or not. Otherwise, if you're not, you spend an hour and a half sitting there without being able to do anything. And then, you know, that's an hour and a half you could have spent helping your constituents. So I'm hoping that there'll be some improvements that might stay. But there's no doubt that Parliament, you know, does require people to go in face to face, and as soon as it's safe to do so, obviously I would welcome a healthy balance, and I think there'll be a lively discussion at that point about what that balance is and which things should stay and which things need to go back to us the old traditional ways of doing things, and there'll probably be a bit of a bun fight around that. So I hope that some things will stay, but I also recognise that the virtual Parliament isn't a complete replacement for the physical Parliament, and obviously that will need to continue, and I hope that it does.
Now, to finish, we've got a question here from Lisa, and this is a positive one as well. I always try and end these with a positive tone, and she's explained that she read in the local news this week about two St Albans businesswomen who have been recognised amongst the UK's 100 most inspirational female entrepreneurs. Do you feel, she's asking this, do you feel St Albans is uniquely set up for women to succeed? And how can this continue post-COVID recovery?
Well, we're incredibly blessed here in St Albans with all sorts of different things. There's a very, very strong sort of Chamber of Commerce. There's very strong networks amongst the retailers and businesses and hospitality and groups like that. There's lots of sort of networking opportunities. We've got a real mix of big companies around the fringes of St Albans, combined with lots of micro companies, sort of in the city centre and in some of the villages. And so we're kind of blessed with that sort of diversity that means that it is a brilliant place for men and women entrepreneurs to succeed. I think, you know, we're also lucky in that we are, you know, we're very close to London, which is great from a sort of connections point of view, but also it's very easy to go outside of London to go to see suppliers and things like that. So we are very blessed in terms of our location, but also the kind of network and culture that we have here. I honestly don't know if we're uniquely placed or not, because I've got no idea what happens in other places, but certainly I'll be happy to promote the merits of St Albans.
Well, that's good to hear, and hopefully it does continue. That's a positive trend that we can see continue in 2021. But for now, for the first interview of 2021, I do thank you for your time, Daisy. And a reminder for those who didn't have their question answered, Daisy will be returning next month. But thank you very much for your time, Daisy.
Pleasure. Thanks, Jason. Take care.